Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Lou Ferrigno, 24 years old, a former sheet metal worker. Mr. America and twice Mr. Universe. He's turned professional this year and is a contender for the Mr. Olympia title. Lou lives with his parents in Brooklyn, New York.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. The Pod of Thunder and Rock and Roll is here. And let's go. The Duff McKagan Joke of the Week.
Hey, Chris Jericho, it's Duff McKagan. I got something that's a little coarser than my usual, but I was talking to a friend, and I said, hey, man, would it be okay if I banged your mom? My friend said, no way. I said, would we still be friends? He said, no. I said, would we be enemies? He said, no. What would we be then? I asked him. He said, we'd be even. There we go. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
We'd be even. Get it? Because that means that I banged your mom. Only Duff McKagan, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, could come up with that one. But at least he forewarned us before he actually told it. I would say a little bit risque. It's not a Friday without the Duff Joke of the Week. Ever since the summer of 2017, I think it was, he's been laying these jokes on us for over a year. And thanks to Duff for never letting us down. And thanks to everyone who booked their cabin for Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Cipar Deux. We were over 70% sold out, and the general on sale was just Wednesday. You guys made it close to a sellout on the very first little pre-sale there. We're going to sell this bad boy. We added some more great talent to the list. We're adding more every single day. I'll run down some of the new awesome additions later on in the show. But right now, I want to get to my guest. The original Incredible Hulk, Lou Ferrigno. Is here, and he's kind of an icon of the 70s. He was a bodybuilder who competed against Arnold Schwarzenegger in the Mr. Olympia contest back in the 70s. Lou was the runner-up, but he and Arnold remained good friends to this day. I'd say that Lou's probably the second most famous bodybuilder of all time behind Arnold, and of course, both of them were in competition in the Pumping Iron documentary, one of my favorite movies of all time. We hear all about Lou's thoughts about Pumping Iron, and how he got interested in bodybuilding in the first place. He was also on Celebrity Apprentice. You'll hear how he tried to get Penn Jillette fired that season and who ultimately got Lou booted out of the boardroom. He trained Michael Jackson for 20 years. It was always kept a secret, and he'll explain why and how Michael was doing right up to his death. Lou was helping him get ready for the big This Is It concert tour. Lou talks about his friendship with Jackson over the years, what it was like with hanging out with him, and we actually recorded this last year, long before the Leaving Neverland documentary came out on HBO, so it's going to be a little bit of a different perspective for both of us. Of course, we hit on Lou's green makeup and shooting 5 seasons of the iconic Incredible Hulk TV show, and how he ended up playing King of Queens. He played himself on King of Queens. Was very funny on that, too. Great guy. Very, very cool. I've since run into him in LAX, somebody that I enjoy seeing and saying hi to. And now I want to present to you the second famous, most famous bodybuilder of all time, the original Incredible Hulk. It's Lou Ferrigno, right here on Talk is Jericho.
At 6'5" and 275 pounds, Lou is the largest bodybuilder ever, and he thinks he can take the title from Arnold this year. So does his father, Matty, who retired from the New York City Police Department to oversee Lou's training.
The first time Arnold came to America, I took Louis backstage, and when Arnold went by us, I'll never forget, I looked at Louis' face, and he just looked at Arnold with awe. I thought God just passed us. And I looked at Louis, I said, what do you think, Louis? And he looked at me and said, see that, he's big.
Okay, so we're here in Calgary with Lou Ferrigno, and we just figured out that we have the same birthday.
Yes.
November
9th. It's amazing. As you begin this interview, you just got off the plane coming from Dubai.
Yeah, yeah, from Saudi Arabia, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is funny because every year, like when it says, like, okay, November 9th, today's birthdays, and I forgot that I always see Lou Ferrigno, yeah. November 9th.
Scorpius, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Scorpius.
The same date.
Yeah, that's funny. But and we're here in Calgary. Do you do a lot of these conventions, like the signing conventions?
Yeah, I do a lot of them because between filming, I got movies coming out. But like, for example, I was at Austria last week, and this show this weekend, Calgary Comic Con, they have over 100,000 people.
Really?
Yeah.
So do you like doing them?
I like it because of the instant gratification. You know, the fans come up. We would talk about three generations of fan,
mm-hmm.
you know, kids, because they've seen my series, also my physicality. So over a 40-year period, they get excited because when they see me, I put a smile on their face, because my whole life, you know, overcoming adversity and what I've accomplished gives them hope.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, because you mentioned three decades, three generations.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been 41 years
yep.
or so. Because if you go through, I mean, from Pumping Iron to Hulk to all the stuff that you did in the 80s, and now King of Queens kind of right. gave you a new birth, that sort of thing.
But it's interesting, when I did Pumping Iron in 1975, it was myself and Arnold, because back then bodybuilding was more like a shadow sport. The public didn't know what bodybuilding was. And we had nothing, because first prize was $750.
Hmm.
You trained a whole year for that competition.
Really?
$750.
And that's Mr. Olympia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Believe it or not. So it changed a lot. But since then, we didn't know what direction we were taking, because it's the sport of bodybuilding. Because back then, all the big guys outside were going to pro football with the money in.
Mm-hmm.
But we were in the bodybuilding. But it's amazing how much changed over 40 years. Now you have all this figure competition, men's fitness. It just exploded like in Hollywood,
mm-hmm.
and even the wrestling federation.
Sure, sure. But you're like a pioneer, like one of the OG
uh-huh.
bodybuilders type things. Let's talk about Pumping Iron, that you mentioned it, because obviously one of my favorite documentaries ever. I've been watching it since I was probably 15 years old. I can quote almost all of it. How was that put together? And you mentioned, because bodybuilding wasn't big, was somebody deciding to try and put a spotlight on it, the filmmakers that approached you to be involved, or how was that?
Well, I competed at the ABC Superstars competition, and I did very well. See, when the book came out, it was on the bestseller list. And then George Butler and Charles Gaines wanted to make this documentary, Pumping Iron, so they approached me in Arnold. And I said, great, it's a great idea, because the concept was in South Africa. So we figured, why not, because it's the first time it could be shown in the theater. But it was interesting that as they were filming Pumping Iron, they almost went bankrupt. So one time they had to get the bodybuilders to pose at the Whitney Museum of Art to raise money for it.
Mm.
Yeah, because I don't know if you know that they couldn't put Arnold on the cover of Pumping Iron because he was too freakish looking. Because the way he looked, they put another guy named Ed Corney on the cover because for the public to embrace it. But when you think about it now, 40-some years later, he became one of the biggest movie stars in the world. And then both of us. But back then, we didn't know where we were going to go. But I was like, we were hoping it would get some attention. But once it came out, that's why people today, they still talk about Pumping Iron, because it'll never be duplicated.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great film because of the blood, sweat, and tears of bodybuilding.
What attracted you to bodybuilding in the first place?
Well, when I was a kid, close to birth, I lost like 75% of my hearing.
Mm-hmm.
I had a severe speech impediment, and I was bullied. So I had to read a lot of comic books. I was like a real-life Walter Mitty to escape the pain. I used to read about the Hulk, Superman, Spider-Man, to fantasize being them. Then one time I went to a store to trade comic books. My father took me, and I saw this magazine, and there was a bodybuilder named Dave Draper on the cover. I said, oh my God, there's a Mr. Universe. I always used to watch Miss Universe. So I took the magazine home. I read it from page to page, and I learned everything I can about bodybuilding, the sport. And I was excited because I felt like there's somewhere I have a dream about competing. And I was skinny, I was a kid, but it was just my passion.
Mm-hmm.
In high school, they used to make fun of me because I'm reading all this muscle magazine, but my passion, because I just loved lifting weights, because it gave me that sense of power and well-being.
Mm-hmm. Kind of took you out of the bullying aspect, uh-huh. too. And I love the dynamic of Pumping Iron, where you have Arnold, who was kind of, I guess he was already the champion,
uh-huh.
and he's living high, you know, smoking cigarettes and or cigars and champagne, and then you're training in like this...
The Dark Horse.
Concrete and mortar gym with yeah. your dad as your trainer.
Right.
It's such a great, you know, dichotomy between the two guys.
Yeah, and you know, at the same time, most people don't realize I did not have a great relationship with my father.
Mm, wow.
Because I don't know if you know this, Chris. Most bodybuilders have had bad relationship with their fathers because of the fact we got in bodybuilding because we wanted that respect. So we built a powerful body that we're never going to be abused anymore. It's a normal thing with big bodybuilding champions. Mm. Very common. So anyway, so that's why that's the whole thing involved, because back then it's just we didn't have a film. It was just pumping iron. It was like a godsend.
Sure, sure. But then, of course, there's all the psychological warfare with Arnold and you. Was that real, or was it show business? Or,
well, I wasn't in my best shape, and Arnold at the time was arrogant, and he was he plays mind games. But he didn't really check me out because I wasn't on my best. But I just knew that being this film, to be on stage with him, just basically the two of us. But that's who we is. At the time, he was a great manipulator. But that's what made the film interesting.
It's great, yeah.
Yeah.
He's like, what did you say, Louis? And you're like, what? What did you say? I'm training Arnold.
Right, exactly. Sometimes I had fantasy throwing the barbell. That one scene when I said, I'm watching you, I almost had a thought, maybe just drop the ball on him. Maybe I could injure him. I could win the competition.
Because you're a lot taller than Arnold, too.
4 inches.
You're like 6'5"?
Yeah.
So, because he was always known for his giant chest and his giant quad, or his shoulders, his delts, his biceps, but you were so much taller. Is that a hindrance in bodybuilding?
It's like the shorter guys. Well, it's very weird that a person like myself had perfect symmetry.
Yeah.
Arnold 6'1", so he broke down the barrier for the tall man, because before him, all the champions were like 5'10".
Right.
He was the first one on the scene that was over 6 feet tall. So he was my idol growing up, and I wanted to beat the best. So I competed with him. And the first Mr. Olympia, I was on stage with him at 22 years old. I won Mr. America and Mr. Universe straight up to Mr. Olympia, because I felt like to be the best, I had to defeat him. So it was still here.
Did you ever beat him?
No, I can't run him up. After I did Pumping Iron, I was going to compete again. He retired, but then the Hulk series came along. So then I was out of competition for 17 years. So one time at the age of 42, I woke up, I said, I feel I want to be in the best shape of my life. It's unfinished business, so I may have come back to bodybuilding. So in 1992, I was 325 pounds of 2% body fat. Heavy squat. I had to learn to develop the hunger to compete again. That was the hardest thing.
Was it like in the 70s that we talked a little bit about those steroids and stuff, and obviously not as prevalent, or maybe it is as prevalent now, but did you guys know what this was, or was it fairly new at the time, or was it something that had been around for bodybuilding, or was it something that guys even did?
You mean the steroids?
Yeah, the steroid stuff, yeah.
It was legal at the time, and I really? Know I did under a doctor. It was legal.
Wow.
And under a doctor care. And I was never big into that kind of situation, but everybody back then, I can't speak for other people. It was always like a small amount because we had great genetics. But now it's so widespread, so bad, because now it's illegal. But these guys today, they're doing the growth hormone, or the insulin, and taking other chemicals. So it's not a winning factor.
Yeah.
But it's all about hard labor, hard work when I competed back then.
Of course, it's still. I mean, just because if you're on the gas, it doesn't mean that you just don't have to do anything.
Right.
And it's interesting, too, like for even in the WWE, like now the steroid testing is so, so stringent. Whereas obviously it didn't used to be in the past, but now it's a non-factor in the WWE. Whereas before it used to be so based around it.
Yeah.
You know, but you still got to put in the time and the effort to still look good, because it's a cosmetic business.
Yeah, because I know in the wrestling world, I mean, steroids was used because the fact that a lot of time it cushions your body because you're taking a beating with a chair, jumping. I mean, I think one of the hardest sports in the world is wrestling, because most people don't realize that you're changing planes, you're almost wrestling every day.
Yeah,
you got to rehearse, and they got to sit around for 4 or 5 hours, and then after the match, you go on the plane for the next event. It's not easy. Then eventually, you know, you get involved with pain pills and drugs that.
It can be. I mean, if you allow yourself to go down that road, you know, when you're talking about waiting 4 or 5 hours, when you were doing your bodybuilding, like Mr. Olympia, how do you, like, obviously you're training and dieting and everything for months and months to peak on this exact day, but day of the show, what were you doing? Light warm-ups? Do you eat anything?
The day of the show, basically 2 days before, you would not be working out, because the whole idea is that you want to be ready the week before. When you go to compete, you should be on vacation. You can't change your body the last week. Maybe deplete the body a little bit of low sodium, the excess water posing. But if you're doing your homework, sometimes you could be ready to peak out perfectly. But if you get the flu, you get a virus, you know, then you're screwed.
Oh, right. The day of the show, then, so at that point, you're just kind of relaxing, and then when you're ready to do your
routine. Because you need to be ready a week before.
Okay, gotcha.
At least, because when you're in your best shape, so just say you travel, you shouldn't be training 2 days before, maybe just posing. just to keep the condition. I mean, you had to be ready a week before.
Now, you mentioned that you worked with the WBF, which was Vince's Vince McMahon's Bodybuilding Federation, which was mid-90s or so. Were you involved as a competitor?
Yeah, because I signed with Vince at the time because I was excited that I was bringing bodybuilding into the mainstream.
Right.
We have these different
gimmicks for the guys, and everybody had a personality.
Yeah, and I liked Vince, but unfortunately, I understand that he had a problem with the government with the whole steroid issue. As far as I know, he had to give up the WBF, so get out of hand. But it's too bad because he was on the right path to show the personalities of the he's the great promoter of all the bodybuilders. So unfortunately, it didn't work out.
Yeah, but that's one of those things, like you said, for bodybuilding, when it was you and Arnold, you guys kind of had those personalities.
Right.
And now I'm not sure. I mean, there was throughout the years, but now I'm not sure even who Mr. Olympia is at this point in time.
Well, there's so many guys on stage. Like, for example, you have guys win like 8 times, 7 times, but the only people the public knows is me and Arnold.
Yeah, you're right.
Exactly. Always going to be like that.
What's your relationship with Arnold?
We're friends. I see him all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we're more mature now, and we have a lot of respect for each other. Mm-hmm. And I know he recently went through a heart surgery again for the third time.
Yeah.
But he seems okay, but I feel for the guy because, you know, you beat your body up and everything, and then, but he's a survivor.
Yeah. You feel pretty good?
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, you look great.
Yeah, I take a day at a time. I don't train heavy. I train light. I enjoy life to the fullest. I don't overindulge in, like, excessive anything I do, falls like eating or falls like drugs or alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
How many, Hank?
Come on, I want to see
10.
10? You're going to do it. Come on, you're going to wipe them out.
I'll do it.
Come on.
So let's start with some of the things that you mentioned, the Hulk series. Now, obviously, that was kind of what put you really on the map.
You did.
And a kid my age, you know, was born in 1970, so I grew up like the Hulk was the show. Like, that was the show, and you were waiting for the Hulk to appear.
8:15, 8:45.
Yeah.
But you know what's funny? Bill Bixby, that show, you talk about being bullied. Uh-huh. Bill Bixby, who played David Banner, was bullied. And then you see the Hulk was perfect because if you want to discuss what bullying is like, watch the Hulk because Bill gets bullied.
Right.
You see the white eyes?
Yeah, exactly. He starts going crazy.
Yeah.
And now you said 8:15 and 8:45.
That's when you see the Hulk out.
Really?
Everybody waits for 15 minutes. They know that 15 minutes before 9 o'clock, you're going to see the second Hulk out.
Wow, so that was how they did the show, every show.
Precisely, almost.
Really?
Yeah.
Ah, that's interesting.
It was great because every nationality embraced it because every one of us has a little Hulk inside of us. So when you see the show, he releases our anger, our demon inside of us. And that even 41 years later, even though you have CGI, everybody still loves the original series. And the beauty about the series, every show had a message, a laser compelling message about life, about depression, anxiety. It was great.
And then the sad music where he walks back, he walks to the next town.
With the duffel bag.
The duffel bag on his back. He's the drifter. But like you said, like the Hulk now and like the Marvel movies and stuff, I don't like the scene. It looks like a cartoon in a movie. I'd rather see, you know, a new generation of a guy like you.
Yeah.
Putting on the foil, so to speak, and doing it live.
Yeah, I would think that you ever see a human Hulk again, but mostly CGI now because of all the technology and the big screen, like you have the Avengers, your spaceship. I mean, I think it got a little carried out of hand.
How did you get the gig as the Hulk?
Well, I was training for the 1977 Mr. Olympia, so I would be in the best shape of my life. But about 6 weeks before my phone rang, they said we have an audition for the Incredible Hulk. I looked at the answering machine and I said, you got to be kidding. Because at the time, they were shooting the pilot with a guy named Richard Keel. He played George and James Bond. Okay, he didn't fit the part. So one time the director came on the set with his son, the boy said to his father, Dad, this is not the Hulk. He's big, but he doesn't look like the character.
Tall and skinny
the comic book. They realized they had a problem. They did a nationwide casting call. So when I could receive the phone call, I went the next day to audition for it. And I went the part. But my heart was into winning the Mr. Olympia 1977. And I went to talk to Joe Weider. He's the company next year. So I was relieved. So I did the Hulk. 24 hours later, I'm in the full makeup, growling, smashing, breaking things. And I kept saying to myself, I just pray that this show gets attention because it's all green and the public don't know what the Hulk is. So when it hit the air, then the rest is history.
How long would it take to put all that makeup on?
3.5 hours, 4 hours sometime. I had to be retouched all day long. I'd be the first one on the set and the last one to leave.
What were they using, like just like grease paint or something?
Well, the face, they had the forehead, nose appliance, they put grease makeup. Mm. But the body was pancake makeup, like a ball of clay. They had to rub it in. It was, you know, I tell you, Chris, some days I just wanted to just leave and quit because I had to stay in that motorhome all day long. I couldn't have lunch with the crew because, you know, of the heat and sometimes the cold. So I had to stay in the motorhome, be refrigerated. So it was my discipline for being a bodybuilder champion to sustain those hours and endure the 5 hours and also the 5 years of the series.
Yeah, because if you walk outside and you smudge against something or something is hot and they see one little bit of real skin on screen,
yeah, kills the illusion. But normally they retouch because sometimes it becomes dry and brittle, but the retouch was uncomfortable.
Wow.
You know, you know, spraying the water, it's almost like, you know, it's irritating.
Yeah. Was that your first major acting gig?
Yeah.
How was it like was it with Bill Bixby, obviously a veteran actor? Was he helping you out?
Definitely, because when I first watched Bill, I was a big fan of his. He'd done different TV series. I was very honored to work with him. I used to watch how he filmed because, you know, as an actor, you have to learn where the scene you're coming from and your performance. So it's a whole crap. And it was funny, shortly after that, I don't know if you know, 1987, I came here to do a play at Stage West Theater.
Oh, in Calgary?
Arsenic and Old Lace. So I decided to do theater, but my first play was
in Calgary.
Yes.
Wow, so you did live theater?
Yeah.
How was that?
It was great, but it's different.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when you film, you could take a break. If you make a mistake, but you're on stage, it's live, you're in front of an audience. Besides the instant gratification, you have to be on the mark. If you forget your lines, you got a problem.
Yeah.
You got to screw everybody
else.
Right.
That's my world, like the wrestling world musician. You have to get it right. You got one chance. You know, you can't mess it up.
Yeah, but how much do you rehearse before you go in the ring?
Well, not really. I mean, at this point in time, it's just you might rehearse something for the match, maybe one or two little things, but mostly just talk about it before, and then rehearsing the interviews, the promos, the speeches. Yeah. You really don't. You just write it out. You work on it backstage.
Oh, really?
You go out there.
Like, for example, say you go out with an opponent, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, before you wrestling, you know, you have like a scream and yelling at each other, the dialogue.
You'll have that kind of written out. Sometimes it's bullet points. Sometimes it's exact.
Yeah.
Whatever it may be. It's not improv anymore. It used to be improv.
So it's like a play almost.
It is.
Because you can't screw up because you have it.
Can't step on each other's lines. It's a scene. Mm-hmm. It's exactly what it is. Was it hard? I mean, now everyone knows Lou Ferrigno, like you said, with your, I don't even want to call it, would you call it a speech impediment or whatever?
Back then, it has to be a speech.
Now, what was it called? It's almost like just your voice, an accent.
No, my voice, a New York accent.
Right, yeah. But people understand that now. But when you were first starting, you said you did a play. Was it a little bit hard with the way you spoke?
Yeah, it was more of a monotone kind of speech.
Mm-hmm.
So about 5 years ago, I had ear surgery, so my left ear now, I don't wear a hearing aid anymore. So basically,
I hear
much better.
Oh.
But I had a very severe, like a monotone speech. But I've learned to work on my speech. What I did is I studied phonetics to learn the inflection of my speech. So I changed that over the course of the years because I figured if I didn't do that, then I'm always going to sound like a person that has a severe hearing loss.
Mm.
So I changed. I worked on that because my ability is that everything in my life is that I maximize what I can do within my capacity, like my passion. Like if I have something lacking behind, I would accelerate that and maximize that. Like, for example, like besides the speech, like if I find new ways to hear better, I would do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Are you kind of like, do you talk to a lot of kids that have hearing issues?
Oh, definitely.
Because you're like a role model for them.
Yeah, I'm a worldwide motivational speaker. I talk about maximizing your personal power because sometimes somebody has a disability and they want that hope. It could be in a wheelchair, maybe one eye, maybe in a cane. But it's not the end of your life. There's always hope. Mm-hmm. And they see what I've overcame and much that I had a fight in my life. They feel they have hope. They can do the same thing.
Mm. Yeah, it's inspirational.
Yep.
Did you do a lot of other acting after The Hulk?
Well, I've done over 40 films, 5 different TV series.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
What are some of the other movies that you had done? Was there like I think, were you like a Hercules one time or something
like
that?
I did Hercules.
Like an Italian, like kind of a shitty movie?
Yeah. they offered me that. It was a nice payday. Right. But I've always wanted to be Hercules.
Uh-huh.
So when you do those Italian spaghetti film, it was fun because we filmed in Rome, Italy. And I knew at the time they dubbed my voice for continuity, but then everything changed after that. Then doing this theater, then I've done comedy like in King of Queens for 7 years, and the movie I Love You, Man.
That was great,
and
too.
And I've done action films. I've got three other films coming out.
So you're always working.
You've
been a nonstop working actor for 41 years.
Yeah, I'm a scorpion workaholic.
See, you know there how you it go. Is. Exactly.
You just have that drive.
That's it, man. You have to. That's a good point, the drive.
We have that drive, mm-hmm. and we thrive on it. Mm-hmm. We love it.
I never realized it was a Scorpio trait, but you just.
But you know what's interesting? People say, don't you take long vacations, relax? I should say, this is my vacation. I enjoy this. Like, for example, my hobby, I'm back to woodworking. Mm. But my one of my greatest achievements 14 years ago, I went through the academy. I became a deputy sheriff.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that in a couple different places.
Well, in LA and San Luis Obispo, but I've been deputized in 15 different states. I'm a certified police officer. And I do a lot of search and rescue because I like giving back, because my father was the NYPD.
Right.
And he always said to me, you can't, you're not perfect. You can't, you can never have a perfect life. He always was very negative towards me. Yeah. So I carry his pain.
Why? Because of his, because of
yes.
His
because when hearing? I lost my hearing, I was not the perfect son. So I carry his pain. Hmm. He was a very negative person because everything he wanted to become, I've become.
Hmm. That kind of
motivated me.
Motivated you, yeah.
Yeah.
So tell me about a little bit with the deputizing. What exactly does that mean? What does it mean when you're deputized?
Well, deputizing mean other states, the fact that I become honorary other states, but I went through the academy and I became a certified deputy sheriff in LA, the real deal. Not honorary in LA, real deal.
So you actually went to police academy?
Sheriff.
Sheriff.
Yeah, I could carry a gun, I have the uniform, everything. I can go on patrol. And do all the things that a deputy sheriff does. I'm a certified deputy sheriff.
So when did you do that? Like, when did you get?
14 years ago.
Okay, 14 years ago. So, and what was your, and why?
Well, I ran into a sheriff at the time, Sheriff Barker. We were talking about law enforcement, my father. He said, why don't you go through the academy? Because I told him how much I love law enforcement. And I said, sure. So I took 6 months off, went through the academy, learned how to shoot and drive, take all these different exams. It was tough. With my whole dining room table covered with all these textbooks, I learned all about the laws of arrest, the Constitution, and then it got easier and easier, like going back to school. But that's something I've always wanted, and I was very honored when I got the badge.
So have you gone out on stakeouts and routines?
I've done it, but you know, I got to be very careful because you know when you're on patrol. I mean, it's not like you're making a movie. It's a real deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be a shooting situation. They shoot deputies. So that's a risk you have to take.
Have you had anything like that happen?
I've came close to it, but it's been tough. But I like to do a search and rescue in the mountains because they have gang-related. They have suicide with AR-5 helicopter. I enjoy doing that because that's my passion.
Looking for people that are lost in the woods sort of thing?
Yeah, lost in the woods, jumping, suicide, motorcycle accident because Angela Forrest, it's motorcycle haven, 500 square miles. A lot of times it's a motorcycle accident, and they get injured in remote areas. So we fly by helicopter, and I would go down to rescue them.
Like on a zip line or something?
Yeah, really? From the helicopter, yeah. We're trained to climb Icy Mountain, up, get airlifted up out of the helicopter.
Wow.
I'm trained to do that.
That's a reality show right there.
Well, it's a real deal. Yeah.
So how do people like call on their cell and say, I'm hurt, or how do you know that they're there?
Well, we get a phone call from the dispatcher. For example, say someone's lost, they would have a cell phone or someone was they were radio, and we would drive up or flag the helicopter right to the scene where they are specifically. And also I teach weapons shooting. Mm. I love guns, and I do a lot of speaking for the department.
Do you have shifts, or they call you, or are you on call?
I do. I make my own hours because I don't take a salary. Mm. So I work with full-time, I work with the reserves. So I enjoy doing that.
That's really cool.
Well, it's a great career move, and I educate these young kids because there's so much brutality now with the police officers, the sheriff, people label them as being bad people, but they forget in the crime scene, they don't see the other side where they have to go through. I mean, like for example in Ferguson, like the cop got beat up. I mean, we're trained though, if we get attacked, we have to retaliate with force.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise
save your life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We have to use deadly force, we have to.
It seems, yeah, like police kind of have a bad rap in a lot of ways. It's kind of the cool thing to do now, but I don't see a lot of brutality when, like you said, if somebody's doing something wrong, it's your job to stop them from doing that.
Yeah, I mean, of course, they're going to have some officers make some mistakes.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody's perfect. But generally speaking, sometimes But someone angry, they just want to blame the cops because let them go out and go on patrol. Let them go out on the street and see what it's like to deal with people throwing sticks and blocks, shooting, for example, gangs and riots. Let's see what they feel like.
Sure.
Yeah.
Have you ever had anybody when you go to talk to them or something, it's like, oh my God, it's Lou Ferrigno about to arrest me?
Well, they see me for a second, then they realize they have to respect me because of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one time I had to rescue this woman, she was in a mountain. She fell down into her lake. So there I was lowering myself from the helicopter. And I remember she looked at me and she fainted because she saw who I was. And I'm saying to myself, great, I got a woman now, she faints. It was funny. She was crying. She said, oh my God, the Hulk is saving me.
The Hulk is saving me, right? Did you get any calls? You did some stuff with like the original Hulk, the Hulk movies that they've done now, like the Marvel comics. You were in those movies, weren't you?
I've done The Void. I did a couple of cameos.
Cameos.
With Stan Lee. And I'm glad to still be part of it.
You're like part of the family.
Yep.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you come out here and you're out here, right? Now, they're all waiting for you, Louis. They want to see what you got. They've never seen you before. Right? You tense your legs, right? Then you look at the crowd, Louis. They're all looking at you. Flash bulbs are going to go off and everything. Then you put your arms like this. You look at your arms like you're admiring, right? You're admiring what you're going to show them. And then you go, boom, like you're saying, take a look at this hunk of man. Something like that, okay? You're trying.
You talk about training and being kind of like known as being one of the best bodybuilders of all time. Now, I read something years ago that I specifically did not research because I want to ask you, did you train Michael Jackson?
20 years.
20 years?
On and off, I kept it a secret.
That's, oh my goodness, well, tell us about that.
Well, I trained Chuck Norris and Bob Wall for many years.
Chuck Norris too?
Yeah, uh-huh.
And Bob?
Bob Wall. He was in Enter the Dragon.
Okay.
So Randy Travis. So what happened, though, I had a good friend of mine. He was Michael Jackson, plastic surgeon. So he said, could you try to train Michael? Because Michael can't go to a gym. And Michael needs some support and some supervisor when it comes to training. I said, sure. So he came to my facility in Santa Monica. We became friends. And he wanted to keep it quiet. So I trained him for the history tour and then also for the last one, on and off for 20 years. We were good friends.
So how would you train Michael Jackson?
Very light. I mean, Michael needed discipline. You would use the bands, very light weights, you know, cardio, flexibility, very light. And, you know, because he had his share of injury. Mm-hmm. But he was a phenomenal person.
Really? Good guy?
Yeah, great.
Yeah?
But nobody knows Michael. Only a few people when you're alone with him. Like, for example, I went to the Neverland Ranch, and he takes me in the car, driving me around. But you can't do that in the street. He had to have a Suburban, you know, a bodyguard. So we had a great time. So I spent a few days with him. I mean, he's such a generous person.
You know, like you said, it's hard for, I mean, we can understand it to a certain degree. We have some fame. People know us, especially when we're here. But a guy like that, that is a household name in every household worldwide. It's like being Paul McCartney or something. Like that level of fame.
Like Mickey Mouse.
Like Mickey Mouse, exactly. The guy can't go out anywhere.
Right.
You know? So like you said, he needs the private training with you.
Yeah, and he can't drive. He gets to an accident. I mean.
Sure.
Yeah, so his life was very sheltered.
He's obviously one of the greatest dancers of all time. A lot of cardio going on stage. Did you have to, was that kind of your, like when you're looking at him, you said lightweight training, were you trying to get him in better cardio shape as well?
Well, more cardio also keep the ligaments and tendons strengthened because as he's getting older, he never exercised because the fact all the dancing trying to minimize his injuries. Mm. And I just made sure that he just stick with the flexibility. Sometimes we use the ball, like for example, the medicine ball, sometimes the air ball, you know, to do ab training. Yeah. And to make sure that everything he did that would be choreographed also with his dancing.
Because his mindset is obviously not to become super buff, but just to get in better shape.
Yeah, because he takes the singing lesson. He rehearses for a long time for that when he goes on tour. So he needs someone to remind him to keep working out, to be on top of it, because his diet was terrible. He would eat sometimes maybe once a day, and he had trouble sleeping because he always hears his music. And so he had a different lifestyle. Musicians live a tough life.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard.
But like you said, it's hard to shut off your mind sometimes, too.
Exactly.
I mean, I have that. I'm sure you do at times when you have so much stuff going on. Like, I rarely sleep. You know, and that actually led to Michael's demise almost because he had that guy giving him stuff to sleep with, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you were training him for that last tour, for the This Is
the
It tour?
The Hits Me tour and the last tour. And then about a month before, I had to do a book tour. That I had the news, I received the news when I was back east that he died of a heart attack. Mm. I don't know if you know, he was in debt for like $430 million.
Really?
Yes, he had to do the tour because he lived in Bahrain, and then the lifestyle he lived, he was in debt for over $400 million.
Just from lifestyle?
Combination of everything. So he was going to make the biggest comeback in history. But then unfortunately, he just died.
Wow. How was he those last few months? Was he looking good? Was he healthy?
Yeah, he was fine. I mean, I was with him. I went to his house and I trained him. He had his family. He was excited about his kids. He would rehearse and do the voice lesson. And then I think it's just all that stress. But when I was with him, he was fine.
I didn't know that he had debt for that much.
Yeah.
It's amazing when you have those guys that have made so much but spend even more. You know, it's like, I save half of everything I make and don't spend the rest, right?
But you can't take it with him. Like, he now the whole family, they're trying to fight it for the estate. But it's a shame because he's such an iconic guy. There'll never be a guy like him. I mean, the way he moved, the way he looked, the way he danced. Who could perform like that?
Sure. And his creativity.
Yeah.
You know, songwriting skills, the perfect package that we'll never see. That's good that you get to spend some time with him. That's really cool. Who else did you train?
Randy Travis, Chuck Norris, Bob Wall. I trained a lot of different actors.
How would you train Chuck Norris?
Well, Bob made Chuck come to me because Chuck was in his 40s, late 40s, and he wanted to build some muscle, get conditioned. When I trained Chuck, he was able to kick higher, because Chuck is really a hell of a world champion. I mean, he's one. If you put him in a fight with Bruce Lee, I was told that he would win.
Really?
Yeah, Chuck. Yeah, like 6-7-time world champion. Great athlete.
Yeah, yeah. You forget about it too, but how many? Yeah. He was a huge movie star at the back in the day as well, right?
But he fought because a lot of times he traveled. Sometimes when he made films, he would go on tour across the country to raise money for the box office for the film. I mean, he worked very hard at it.
Mm-hmm.
People think that comes easy. It didn't come easy for him.
So when you're talking about, you mentioned King of Queens and the comedy part, you were great in that. Comedy come naturally for you? What's the difference between comedy and action? And
well, I did a movie called The Godson with Rodney Dangerfield and Dom DeLuise. So one time the producers of The King of Queens said, why not have Lou on the show? We'll make him a neighbor. So I did the one episode and they said, well, could you play yourself? I said, sure, because every day in life I go through the same thing, Hulk jokes, cracking. So I did it. So it became a recurring role for 7 years.
Yeah.
It was great because I've always wanted to do comedy. I like to make people laugh.
Uh-huh.
Then the movie came out, I Love You, Man. Yeah. So that was at the next level.
That was great, too.
Yeah.
So when you're doing comedy for King of Queens, once again, like were those guys, would they help you? Or do you have just natural comic timing?
Well, when you do a sitcom, you read in front of the network on Monday. And from the script. So whatever doesn't sound funny, they eliminate it. Then you have the rehearsal. But you got to remember, when you do a sitcom, you're in front of like 100, 200 people, and you only get two takes. And it's live.
Only two takes.
It's like a soap opera. Uh-huh. So you have to know your lines and you have to be connected, because comedy, you can't try to be funny. It's just, you have to be connected
with the
character.
Yeah.
It's hard, but when you get into it, but there's a lot of tension. But these guys that have done it for a long time, like Kevin James, Jerry Siddle, they're just so natural at it.
Mm-hmm. It's like you said, it's just like a team sport. Just keep your stick on the ice
and
you'll be funny. And that's the number one rule of comedy. Don't try and be funny.
Exactly.
Yeah, just let the...
Yeah, I learned a lot being with them. It's amazing because how they have the timing, what they can do in front of the camera. Like Kevin Smith, James is wonderful.
Mm.
I mean, they're very creative.
Do you, and you said you have other movies coming out now. How many movies do you do a year?
Well, I have a British film that came out called Instant Death. It was the action film. And I did another movie called Enter the Fire, kind of like a Karate Kid kind of film. I filmed that in San Francisco about a year and a half ago. Then I did a comedy of Game of Thrones called Purge the Throne. I filmed last year in England for a month. That'll be coming out. But what I'm really excited about, I'm doing a new TV series for Discovery Channel called Pumped.
Pumped.
It's like the Celebrity Apprentice of Fitness and Bodybuilding. Meaning, for example, we have a lot of competitors for the audition, but you only have 12 competitors. They bring their brand. They bring their brand to the show, and to take it to the next level. And we give them the different challenges. Me and my partner, so we see how far. Because there's not much money in bodybuilding and fitness, but they can have a chance to be a businessman, be an actor. But they will learn from me and my partner to the next level if they can accomplished it. Now we're talking about anybody, any walk of life, like a guy having a missing leg, but somebody that the public will watch it. It's like Donald Trump. You know, when you watch it, because the fact that he raised money for charity, but these are the people that come from like all parts of the world. They want to be successful. Mm-hmm. So it'd be a fabulous show called Pumped.
Hmm. And it's interesting too, like you mentioned, bodybuilding. You mentioned that you guys got made $750 back in the day. It's not that much different now. You're not making big money as a bodybuilder. Even if you're Mr. Olympia now in 2018, there's not a lot of money at stake. Is that
correct? Well, I think it's like over 100,000, but you got to forget the diet, the training, the traveling. I mean, you know, the food intake or the preparation. So the money they make is doing a lot of exhibition, traveling. I mean, they can make a good living, but usually it's Mr. Olympia. But it's the stress of keep winning and your body under all that stress of the heavy training. Like Ronnie Coleman, he was 8-time Mr. Olympia.
Yeah.
And, you know, he, I don't know if you ever see him on YouTube, but he does bend over rope with 500 pounds. He squatted one time 800 pounds for 3 reps. And now he's in a wheelchair. He injured himself.
Really?
Yeah, because he had back surgery, and then he came back training heavy again. I think he's one of the greatest of all time. But very hard on the body. But the thing is, when I competed, I love pain. To be a world champion, you have to love pain. You got to go beyond that barrier. You think you can't do two more? You have to do two more if you want to be successful. That's what bodybuilders take. Like the Olympic lifters. If they're convinced they can't lift 500, they're not going to lift 500. It's all in the mind how far, how much you can take the body to.
Are you talking the pain of like that feeling, that burn?
The burn, not the pain like you're having surgery. With that pain, for example, if you feel that the body's telling you you can't handle two more, but your mind takes you further to increase the size and the density of your muscles to train even harder. Hmm. That's why, like myself, you take Arnold, the drive we had, the reason why I became a champion, because not just having genetics, I had that incredible hunger, the drive to be the world champion. I said nothing could have stopped me.
When you think about bodybuilding in 2018, is there a lot of differences from 1975 to now?
Oh yeah, because I came back and I was 268 pounds. So when I came back in the 90s to compete, the hardest thing is to develop the hunger to compete, because I had a wife and 2 kids at the time. Mm. And, you know, my lifestyle was different. You know, you have a nice house, and not like I was living in an apartment, you know, and you only have a few dollars to buy food. So I had to develop the hunger, but I had to come back knowing that I had to be like 30, 40 pounds more, heavier, bigger. Because in the 70s, you had guys that competed, they weighed like maybe 220, 230, but then when I came back in the 90s, we're talking about like 260, 270. So I got my weight to 325, because I was the oldest competitor. When I retired, I was a younger competitor. Mm. So I had to prove to the world I looked like a 90s bodybuilder, not like in the 70s.
Oh, wow. So how did you do that?
I spent 2 years to train heavy squat again, heavy bench pressing, and then do more cardio because of the technology of diet and cardio. I was able to put more size on, and then different ways of training. Instead of starving yourself like in the 70s, because we didn't have the cardio equipment or the fancy equipment we have today.
You see some of those old gyms in the 70s, it's like so ridiculous, the stuff you guys had to use.
Yeah, you get an Olympic bar, you put bars on the end, you stick the other bar on the wall, and you improvise, like dumbbells. Like if I had to do leg curls, I lay on the bench and put a dumbbell between my feet and do leg curls.
Because they didn't have a leg curl machine?
Nope.
Wow.
Yeah.
When did that all happen? Because it was like the pre-core training, there's a certain level with all the machines, that started like in the 80s then?
Yeah, that started in the 80s. The whole revolution started when the Nautilus machine came
out. Nautilus, that's it, yeah.
Yeah, and then they started to make other equipment similar to the Nautilus machines, like the leg extension, hash squat, incline squat, different angles. Like you have seated calf machine. I didn't have a seated calf machine. I put a bar on my knees and then find a way to do seated calf.
I was in Japan a couple of years ago, and they had a couple of things, and there was like a wheel that spins with like wooden, like kind of little wooden pieces on it that I guess was supposed to massage your back. And then there was the ribbon that goes around your stomach that was supposed to work.
Yeah. It's all bullshit.
Yeah, it's all bullshit, right?
But it was a gimmick back then.
Yeah. And as far as the dieting and nutrition, is it more of a science now?
Yeah, it's 75% now of training. Because when I came back to competition, I was able to eat 4 or 5 times a day. Because you learned that when you do cardio, you increase your cardio, also you could consume more calories. So that can help to put on the added muscle and body weight.
Because back in the 70s too, it was like raw eggs, liver.
Yeah, meat and water, maybe one banana a day. You starve yourself, otherwise you build your size on, and then you have to almost burn all the fat, you lose a lot of size. But now it's the other way around. If you're muscular, you can almost train, increase your size to the day of the show, and maybe lose 5 pounds instead of losing 15, 25 pounds.
Mm. What was your calling card as a bodybuilder? Chest, arms, abs, everything?
I would say overall my size, my trap, my chest, and the arm.
Mm. That was kind of it. So what was your arm workout? What'd you do for that?
The arm routine, I would do maybe 12, 14 sets of body power. It's always like a barbell curl, incline dumbbell curl, and the concentration curl. I never really overtrained. I trained body power twice a week because I knew that I learned to listen to my body, because most bodybuilders have a tendency to overtrain, and they just end up losing size.
Mm. Explain that to someone who might not understand what overtraining is.
Overtraining means, for example, say you and I go to the gym, we work out, and I say we're going to do a body power like chest. Say we do 3 exercises. And you decide to do maybe 15 exercises because you think more the better. And you walk out of the gym, you're so sore and you're hurting all the time. That's overtraining. You can only train only so many sets for the muscle, but you need 72 hours to recuperate.
Mm-hmm. It's the same with protein too. Like, you, people eat so much protein, but I was always told body's like a cup. And once you get to that protein, there's only so much you can take. And then after that, it just kind of will overflow and just be useless.
Oh, definitely, because your body will only utilize so much protein. Like, for example, I would say the most I consume, one time I'll consume maybe 300 grams of protein, like 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight.
Right.
Now probably 1 gram of protein for every 2.5 pounds of body weight. But you can only absorb so much protein. If it's too much protein, then it's going to turn to fat. It'll be extra calorie.
Do you follow bodybuilding to this day?
Oh, I do. I've had a bodybuilding competition the last 4 years myself, the Ferrigno Legacy.
Where's that?
I don't have the time to, Palm Springs.
Okay.
But I don't have the time to do it anymore, but I do follow bodybuilding because I think it's so popular now, especially when it comes to the men's physique, and now you have the figure. But the big change when you have women competing, and you have women in the gym working out, because when I was in the 70s working out, you never saw a woman in the gym. Yeah.
So if you did, it was like a Bev Francis, just a monster, right?
Yeah, she was like one of the first ones.
Yeah.
But before that, there were no women in the gym.
So really?
It was only men, only guys. Uh-huh. Okay. I remember when I came here to Canada in the 70s, no women working out in the gym. Even the early 80s. Yeah, you had a gym for women and a gym for men. So now it's co-ed.
It's amazing how much that's changed, uh-huh. how accepted it is now in society, and almost necessary. It's people are expected to go to the gym now.
Yeah, it's like a rule of thumb. It's your health, because health is your greatest wealth. And a lot of people, especially in America, it's a big obesity. Like a
sure.
lot of kids, you know, on video games, on the iPhone, they don't work out. Because when I was young, we didn't have Facebook. We didn't have all these video games. So it's more involved in athletic activity.
Mm-hmm.
Today, there's so much young kids being lazy mm-hmm. with the headphones,
yeah.
iPhone. And it's sad because they don't appreciate taking care of their bodies, and that's why when they get older, they go to drugs and alcohol and then ruin their bodies.
It's amazing, even for myself. I used to read so much, read books. I had a book going all the time. I still do, but it takes me 8 months to read it, because if you have a second, you're always on your phone, looking around, going on the internet, seeing what's happening,
yeah.
right?
There I have to read it 2 or 3 times to retain it.
Yeah.
It's probably the same way.
Yeah, the same
you
thing.
You have to labor at it. Some people just read it. They have that photograph memory.
Yeah, but that's a couple of last things I just want to ask you about. When you mentioned Trump, when you did Celebrity Apprentice,
yep.
how was that show for you?
It was tough.
In
because when I came on the show, they expected all brawn, no brain.
Mm.
Okay, here comes this big athlete, the Incredible Hulk. Let's see what he can do. I was the only athlete to make it the 9th show. They were afraid of me, the guys, because in the boardroom, I said how I felt, because I had that drive. I said to myself, I want to raise money for my charity, Muscular Dystrophy and ALS, which I raised $100,000. Donald Trump was great with me. He respects people that work hard, even though he's a loose cannon.
Yeah.
But I would get involved in the politics.
Yeah, yeah.
But I had a great time doing the show, because you're with singers, you're with musicians, you're with different breed of people. Everybody on the show are millionaires.
Uh-huh.
And then also you had the women you work with. So no one likes to get fired. And it's brutal, because you're up 5 o'clock in the morning in front of the camera for all day long, from like 6 in the morning to almost midnight.
I got asked to do that show a couple times. It just never worked out. And I was like you said, like, I wonder how it would do on that when you have a group of a bunch of alphas, millionaires,
yeah.
all very successful, having to kind of fall into line. I'm sure some people were kind of harder to get along with than others.
Well, you're dealing with all the ego.
Yes.
And I didn't give a rat's ass about the ego, because most people would be intimidated. But the nice thing about Celebrity Apprentice, the ego down the window. All about how you perform, which was great.
Yeah.
Because you're in the boardroom with Donald Trump, ego doesn't help you. It's all about how you perform and what you do.
Right. Who else is on the show with you this your season?
Penn Jillette, George Takei,
okay.
Arsenio Hall.
Right.
And the one I did, Arsenio Hall won.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they were intimidated by you? Scared of you?
Well, they were afraid because the guys in the boardroom, because I didn't care what I had to say, because you know when you're working together with a team, you gotta be careful what you say, because then you could hurt yourself. Because part of the project. But in the boardroom, it was my honesty. I was like a drill sergeant. I just said what I thought. I didn't care.
So do they have to have you, like, do you have to like, come up with stuff to sell on the street? Like, I've seen that before. We have to come up with a product and go sell this 20 of these on the street in an hour. Like, was it that sort of thing,
too? Yeah, they give you a product. Like, for example, they say one project we have, like, on Madison, like, Fifth Avenue, you have the window displayed. So, okay, we had these two line of clothing. We wanted to display the line of clothing, and you have to develop the presentation of it. But the whole time when you're working, you have to think of two people that you think they have to be fired. Because when you go in the boardroom, someone has to get fired. So you have to tell that Donald Trump, the person you think who should be fired. Like you and I could be working together.
Yeah.
And you may think we're good friends. But if I think you're the weakest person, I have to bring your name up in the boardroom. I'll have a choice.
Yeah.
So when that happens, it sucks because if you don't get fired, then the next day you hate that person even more.
Oh, yeah. Who did you try and get fired? Didn't?
Penn Jillette.
Okay.
Well, it was tough. George K. one time. So it was tough. I hated to do it because...
It's the strategy of the show, though.
Yeah. At the beginning, it was wonderful. But as time goes on, when you do the show, you end up hating everybody because it's like being in a war. Like,
who got you fired?
Well, apparently, what everyone did, which I didn't know, but they have received the project, they were texting other people to learn how to come up with ideas for the show. I never had the advantage of texting. So I remember that when I had time to get fired, that hurt against me because I was unable to do commercial stuff on the computer. And I didn't mind getting fired because it was tough. After yeah. nine show, it gets brutal.
Yeah.
The one that done well, for example, the singer, the musician, because they would choose something and they could sing a song. So that was the advantage. But I learned a lot of the show. I learned a lot about branding.
Mm. In what way?
Well, how to market yourself, your name and everything. Yeah. Because Donald Trump made his money by branding, like Trump Tower, Trump Clothing. And he's a genius.
President of the United States.
Exactly. Yeah. Like yourself, you.
Yeah.
Like Vince McMahon, you, same thing, you brand your name.
Absolutely.
In wrestling. And that carries on to other things like marketing, like for example, products, endorsement, t-shirts.
But that's the thing, like you and I are the same. Obviously, okay, you're known for acting, but you're also the deputy. You've got Hulk, you've got the pump right. thing. You know, it's the same with this podcast and wrestling, my band. It's the way to ensure that you have longevity in this business.
Exactly. And also, it's all about reinventing yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because when you get older, because most people in the business are 22, 23, but as you get older, you have different passion, but you reinvent yourself. The beauty about the social media today, you can exploit your brand worldwide.
Mm. Are you on social media?
Yeah, my Facebook is like 2.6 million.
Take advantage of that.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's amazing because a lot of times you're on the computer and you say to yourself, you read the news, you say, hey, let me go on Facebook, let me see what so-and-so is doing. That's the beauty of the great social media.
Sure.
It's got its advantages and disadvantages.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're on it too much, you get obsessed with it, all that sort of thing.
Yeah,
too.
Like for example, say you're on a plane, you get to an argument or something, somebody's got an iPhone.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're going to make a big scene like yeah. you have, with your name and everything.
Right.
If it's Joe Blow, the next guy, they won't make anything out of it.
Yeah. Last couple of questions. What's your favorite of all the stuff you've done? What are some of your favorite performances that you've had in the movies or on TV?
In the movies?
Like your favorite role that you played?
As far as the movies and television?
Yeah, yeah.
I would say...
Like we know you as the Hulk. We know you from I Love You, Man. But is there a movie that maybe people haven't seen that you really enjoyed?
Yes. I think with the movie Cage. I played a soldier in Vietnam that was shot in the head. I become mentally deficient. And these mob, they kidnapped me. They used me as a human cockfighter in the cage for money.
Oh.
So it got a lot of reviews. That was about 30-some years ago. But that needed more attention because now you see similar movies to it. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Did you do a lot of those type of movies as a leading man where they would write a role, like you said, like for
Yeah,
you?
Like for example, in England, I filmed this movie, this action film. And it's funny, I was getting massages every night because I'm saying to myself, I'm not 20 years old, so all the fighting, the punching, I'm getting the tissue therapy. I'm very proud of that movie. I would say Instant Death is one of my favorite movies because it's about a guy from the Special Forces. They harm. They kill his, my granddaughter, and they harm. They cut my daughter's eyes out. So I go on the revenge, and you see, like, it's almost like the movie Taken with Liam Neeson. Yeah, yeah, it's a very heavy-duty action film.
Is that the one you just did, a recent one?
Yeah, 2 years ago, yes.
Wow. So here you are at 66, still being the leading man in action movies. I mean, that's it's because that's, you know, you're in the Stallone category. I mean, Arnold still does it, and you still do it. I mean, that's a lot of work to do for a guy your age. But like you said, you don't care. You want to do it.
Also thanks for exercise and training, because 50-some years ago, it would be impossible. The only one today that got longevity, I think, in the 80s, like Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
He could still pull it off.
Right.
But years ago, you didn't have anybody in the 70s and 80s, except a great stage actor. But for action film, like Stallone, like Arnold, they still pull it off like at 70 years old.
Isn't it amazing, like, when you think of our fathers? Like, when my dad, I'm 47. My dad was 47. He was, like, wearing sweatsuits and big glasses. And your dad in Pumping Iron...
He was 50.
50. He looked like he was 75.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Now it's like times have changed to where the age doesn't really make much of a difference as long as you still keep yourself in shape and still try to look good.
It's a mindset.
Right.
If you keep feeling like, for example, if you stop telling yourself, okay, I'm 66, I have to act like 66. Like, I meet a lot of people that are my age.
Yeah.
They look like they're 75, 80. I meet people 10 years younger than me. They look like they're 75, 80. The biggest factor is not working out and not eating right, not taking care of yourself. Mm-hmm. That's the biggest factor. Because mm-hmm. when you have that combination, that gives you the mentality knowing that you're young inside of you. You don't have to equate yourself with the age you are.
You're right. I saw the Stones last year to see Mick Jagger on stage at 73 or 4. Still the greatest frontman in the world. Not a great frontman for a 70-year-old, a great frontman for anybody.
Yeah.
You know, and still plays the part, looks the part, and sounds great, you know, and looks great. That's the secret. Last question. Who do you think is the greatest bodybuilder of all time?
Lou Ferrigno.
Besides you?
Schwarzenegger.
Really?
The reason why I say I'm the greatest, because I never really reached my full potential.
In what way?
Arnold even said, when I competed with him at 34, he said, if I had a loose body, no one could ever beat me. Well, because I had sidetracked, you know, with the Pumping Iron, with the Hulk, I never really reached my full potential.
Oh.
So, I would say one of my all-time favorite, I would say Steve Reeves.
Mm.
He played the original Hercules.
Yeah.
He was a perfect male specimen of bodybuilding. But you can remember, I had to hand it to Arnold, because next to me, I would say right up, way up there, because, you know, he's the hell of a bodybuilder.
Do you think if you had not done Hulk and all the stuff, that you would have been Mr. Olympia?
Oh yeah, about 7-8 times.
Wow.
Definitely.
Wow.
But what's funny is that if I did it, I wouldn't have the fame and the notoriety.
Sure.
Notoriety I have now.
You could be like Dave Draper or like Dorian Yates or somebody that won 8 times and no one really knows.
Exactly, because it's not in the mainstream.
Yeah, you're right. Right.
Yep.
You became mainstream with Hulk and Ken.
The
reason why you didn't become Olympia is the reason why we're sitting here today.
Exactly.
Because of the Hulk.
I mean, it was my biggest dream my whole life to be Mr. Olympia.
Yeah.
But I can't have both.
Yeah, you did pretty good otherwise, though.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Lou, thank you so much for doing this, man.
Thank you.
We're shaking hands.
You too.
Audio.
These people have never seen your arms. They've seen Arnold. So hold that pose a while. And I say, in this pose, just tilt your body a little, because there's people on this side of the theater and there's people on this side of the theater. They want to see you. So just tilt your body just slightly like this, right? Try that, Lou. Attaboy.
All right, thanks to Lou Ferrigno. Lou's got a couple movies coming out this year, and you can keep up with everything he's got going on by following him on Instagram. He's at @TheOfficialLouFerrigno. He also posts some pretty cool throwback pictures from his early days bodybuilding. Great guys you could hear, and I love the stories about Pumping Iron. Go watch that documentary if you haven't seen it. It's amazing. Okay, did you book your cabin for Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea Part 2? Setting sail January 20th, 2020. So many 20s, because that vacation is going to be 20 times better than any vacation you've ever had. Cabins went on sale on Wednesday at ChrisJerichoCruise.com, and I hope you'll be joining us, because we added some more killer talent to the lineup, man. Like I said, we got the Wolfpack, the NWO, whatever you want to call them. Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, and Sean Waltman, X-Pac, will be there, along with our host, comedian Brad Williams. Vicky Carrero is our special cruise director.
Fozzy's going to be playing a bunch of shows during the cruise. Farewell to Fear. Rubik's Cube, the ultimate 80s tribute band with PJ Farley and Steve Brown from Trickster. Joey Quesada from ZO2 are in that band. It's going to be a blast. AEW, great wrestling is going to happen. And we haven't even gotten into who's going to be there from AEW. DDP will be back doing live DDP yoga workshops on the ship. Jake the Snake Roberts is going to be on board. Beyond the Darkness doing paranormal activity, paranormal experiences. It's going to be a lot of fun. Bruce Jingles will be doing comedy on board the cruise as well. So much stuff going on, and we're very, very excited. Like I said, the cruise, the bulk is sold out. Still got some cabins ready, though. Cabins available. ChrisJerichoCruise.com. Sign up. Don't miss the vacation of a lifetime. And trust me, we got a lot of big names coming up. Speaking of big names, coming up on Wednesday, it's the biggest name in wrestling that you have never heard of. I'm talking about Rebel Starbuck, who is the number one wrestler in Finland history. Has also really cultivated his name all across Europe, and especially in Japan, one of Tajiri's great rivals, the Buzzsaw, the Japanese Buzzsaw. If you haven't heard of the Rebel Starbuck, you're going to hear from him on Wednesday. I actually started my career with him. And he's gone on to become very successful on a worldwide basis, but never worked in the States. So we will be happy to let you know all about the Rebel Starbuck this Wednesday on Talk is Jericho. In the meantime and in between time, have a great weekend. Be safe. Peace, love, and hugs. Stay cool. Stay hard. Stay hungry. And have a great, great weekend. Oh, yeah. All right. I'm training Arnold.